afternoon. I'm Karen Hartglass, and you are listening to It's All About Food. It's April 18th, 2012, and we have a lot of work to do. And you know, on this show, I try and connect the dots between our food choices and really all life on Earth. The life of humans, our personal health, the health of our families, the life of other animals on the planet, and the life of the planet itself. And there are so many things that are involved with the food that we eat. Each bite has a story, almost. And yet there's a bigger picture, and we're going to be talking about that today, and I really am looking forward to this conversation. I am going to invite my guest, Peter Seidel, who's the author of a book that I just finished reading, Invisible Walls, Why We Ignore the Damage We Inflict on the Planet and Ourselves. He's an environmental architect and planner who studied with world-renowned Miles van der Rohe and Ludwig Hilbersheimer, both of the Bauhaus in Germany. Welcome to It's All About Food, Peter.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm glad to be with you.
I don't believe in coincidences, and I found this book, which actually came out in 1998. And I'm always looking for interesting topics and things to kind of connect the dots for me in terms of how to make this world a better place. And I was looking over at Prometheus Books and found your book and read it, and good. sometimes the world seems so overwhelming and there are so many things that need to be done, but the first step is just to put it all down on paper. And I'm really glad that you gave us this guidebook on what we need to do. I'm wondering how you got to write Invisible Walls. What was the motivation that caused you to put all of this information in a book?
Well, I was originally an architect, I suppose doing the worst of all kinds of things environmentally. I worked on the Air Force Academy and all glass office buildings and things like that for a big, was the leading firm at that time. And somebody gave me a book called The Challenge of Man's Future. And it was about world population and resources and so on. And that startled me. And I said, oh my gosh. And so I had to remake my life, and I started teaching. And then through that, I developed some system of building new towns, and I got a job to design a series of new towns down here in Cincinnati, or one new town. It was going to be for 60,000 to 80,000 people, and unfortunately it fell through. And at that time, then there was a real developing interest in environmental architecture, solar energy, energy conservation. So I fit right into that, and I was doing things here and developing projects here on that. And then all of a sudden, it happened when Ronald Reagan became president. He ripped the solar collectors off the White House. And efforts to conserve energy and all that went out the window. And then I sat and thought, my gosh, trying to do this doesn't make any sense. Why? Why is it we know all these things that are so wrong and that are happening? Why do we now just disregard all of this? And I'm thinking about that. Well, it ended up with a book.
Well, it's a good one. When that Ronald Reagan era, a lot of people point to it as a real turning point in our society, and not necessarily a good one, although he has a great many fans that loved him as a president. I was never one of his fans. And there are a lot of things that he put into place that have had such detrimental effects on our society, and we're really just realizing them now. But I didn't know that he ripped the solar panels off.
Carter put solar panels on the White House. And he was trying to do what he could to conserve energy, you know, right, and make more fuel-efficient cars. And all that out the window it went.
Well, it I don't like to look back so, too often because I want to keep moving forward, but we can, if we want to, learn things from the past. But I think, gosh, you know, what a world we could have had today if we had started in the Carter Reagan time period of really trying to become energy independent and moving forward with solar energy and other energy oil-free alternatives. But we didn't.
It would be all different.
It would be. It would be such a beautiful place. Okay, but I'm going to hold back my tears.
Okay, and we have to.
And I'm going to take a deep breath in whatever kind of air I'm breathing right now and try and get enough oxygen out of it. And I want to talk about the beginning of the book where you talk about the limitations of our brain, because it really helped me feel better to understand at least why we do some of the awful things that we do.
We have to understand this. We have to learn what our weak, you know, where our problems are within ourselves. This is absolutely essential if we're going to overcome these problems. We have to understand where they are within us, because it's from us all these problems evolve.
Right.
You know, and we can't point to them. It's actually, these are things in all of us, the way we're constructed, the way we're made.
It makes me feel a little better understanding the weaknesses. On the other hand, as we get later on into the book, it gets a little scary to realize that we all have the potential to do great good, and we also could turn in the opposite direction and just do horrific things. And it's within all of us.
Yeah.
Oh, that's chilling.
the chilling part is, you know, and I've just gone over all of this, and then when I got to the point where I made suggestions, well, you know, these are the problems. Here's what we should do. And I started reading about that, and then I began to really get startled, and you know, because all these suggestions, you know, sort of are no place. We're worse off now than we were then.
Yeah. Can you just? There's so many things I want to talk about. Can you just talk about in our brain this filtering that we do that is so helpful and yet limiting?
Well, the filtering is. Well, there's a psychologist, and he says that we take in about 1/1,000,000,000th of all the what's going on around us.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think of what's going on around us, there's, you know, as far as, you know, electromagnetic waves, there's a vast spectrum of them. And our eyes only take in a little piece of this. We are not very good at smells. We're not very good at many, many things. So we just take in a tiny portion of this. Well, of what we take in, we can't remember it all either. And of course, a lot of it doesn't make sense to us in our brain. Our brain, we have to deal with things that we can make sense, that our brain will make sense of and be able to do something with. And then when it does that, there's still so much information out there that we would get totally confused by it unless we filter out and pick out things to pay attention to and to remember. So of all the things that are going on out there around us, only a little bit of it gets and draws our attention and gets remembered.
It's fascinating thinking about it because we perceive, we have this idea of what the world is, and we really have no idea what the world is really about. We perceive so little of it.
Yeah, well, we do perceive a little bit of it, but of course it's in our viewpoint. An interesting thing, the world as we see it is totally different than what the world really is. For instance, the world has no color at all. The color comes from, there are different wavelengths that are reflected off of objects, and these wavelengths come into our eyes And then the different wavelengths get transferred into different meanings to us, and that's colors. So all of a sudden, these things that have no colors begin to, which is all inside our heads, where these colors occur.
Yeah, that's just starting off all kinds of other things that I don't even know if I want to go there, but I'm thinking about those people who are colorblind who might feel stigmatized that they're colorblind, but actually they've got their own unique way of seeing the world.
Yeah, and they're just a little bit more colorblind than the rest of us.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the color, of course, is in one sense an illusion, in another sense it's not, because the colors represent different wavelengths.
Okay. This is all really interesting. Then the other part of the filtering thing is helped me understand why it's so difficult to communicate, even with the people that we know, because we're all taking in information. We're not remembering every word that everyone is saying to us, and we're kind of interpreting it, and that's what we're remembering, our interpretation, and that can lead to a lot of misleading information.
It does. We all build up the world we think we see is really a world inside our minds. We each build up in our minds a model of the world, and we interact with that model that's in our minds. And this can be, of course, different for different people. And so, of course, you know, when you have one model in your mind and another person has a different, sees something different, then there is a communication problem, sure.
Okay, so we're dealing with our limited brains, and as a result, we make all kinds of decisions, and obviously many of the decisions today are not the best ones that we could make for ourselves and for the future of the planet.
I'm afraid not.
But we do have hope, right? Now, you wrote this book in 1998, and I think that most of the information in here, if not all of it, is very fresh and very applicable to what's going on today. The only thing that's missing in here is, so here we are, what is it, like 14 years later, and we now have the internet and we have social networking. And I think that's just exaggerated a lot of the things that you talk about in your book.
Yeah, well, it's opening up a whole world, whole space of some things that are very different that I don't think we totally understand yet. But it's also closing up things too, because we have only so much time per day to think and to absorb things and store things. And when we put something else in, we're replacing something else. So, you know, one thing is replacing another. You know, for instance, a lot of information we're getting, say, is not from newspapers. We're getting it from the internet. Now, there's certain advantages to that, but there's also newspapers. I'm from Cincinnati, my local newspaper. It had a whole staff of reporters that would hang around City Hall, and they really got to know. There was a reporter on education, one on religion, you know, a whole series of them. Now, this has so been cut back, and a lot of people don't get the paper, that a lot of these things just don't, from the local community, no longer reach the people that live there.
And people are looking, for the most part, for very select information.
Yeah, that's what you get on the internet. So on the internet, interesting, you know, what we're doing is we're communicating, connecting more with people, you know, all over the world, and less with people that live right around us.
Mm-hmm. And what's the danger of that? That's a loaded question.
That's a big question. It I think it requires a lot of thought. and a lot. And it would take a lot of time to talk, to think about it and talk about it. And so I won't dare.
Okay. Well, so let's move a little further into this book. Now, what I really like about it is it was explaining, I don't listen to the news all the time because I find it's very sensational. I find it's very one-sided. I don't find that it's really news. A lot of time I call it the olds because I'm hearing things that I knew about already. And but I always get I get anxious. I get frustrated. I get disappointed because I'm not hearing what I really want to hear. And what happens is most people that are listening are kind of numbed and dumbed down into all this, like one thought. Everyone's getting the same information. We all have the same thoughts. I mean, some of them are a little sided to the left and some of them are a little sided to the right. And so we all start thinking about the same stuff. And most of it is so trivial. When we're here, when on the news, when they're talking about makeup and fashion, and they're not talking about poverty and hunger and environmental problems, how does this happen, and why is this happening? And this is part of what's in our human nature.
That's true. I listen to NPR while I'm preparing food and eating and so on. And so I get a lot of information from that. And an awful lot of it is about, as you could say, the latest this and that and fashion and rock music or sports. This thing that's been going on is the political campaign, which has been taking up so much time. And it's all like a horse race, you know, who's ahead? You know, and not real substance.
That's right. No, there's no substance. I like what you said later in the book. I don't want to jump right into what we can do. I kind of want to save the good stuff for later. But you talk about maybe having an exam or something that politicians need to pass in order to qualify to be a politician, and that is a brilliant idea.
Yeah, or would they fight that though?
Well, they fight everything. We shouldn't have these super PACs. We shouldn't have it. It shouldn't be just the rich who can run for office.
I know, and one thing is that politicians spend so much time campaigning. Well, there's an interesting quote in the book from Kenneth Boulding, economist, and he said, basically, the things that qualify or enable people to run for office disqualify them for having it, for running it. And that's true, I think. You know, they should be learning things and understanding how the world works and understanding. They should be learning something about science, because we don't have enough people who want. You know, the people in all these places, they don't have respect for science.
You mentioned something about science that was intriguing to me, and I've been reading articles about some of it, where a lot of the decisions we make, a lot of the work that we do is really tainted in some way by our own perceptions, and even science that we want to think is true and pure comes with a lot of subjectivity. There's even been some articles talking about different studies that have been done and the results that they got, and then later they repeated the studies and they have diminishing returns somehow. And this is related to the people that are doing the experiment, who think they're really objective, still have some degree of subjectivity in anticipating some of the results.
Well, a good scientist, to be any good, you have to be as objective as you possibly can and not put in any of your own wishes or thoughts or anything like it. And when results are come up with, all results in science are tentative. In other words, they all stand there to be ripped down if other evidence shows that this is not correct. And this is something very important for people to understand about science, is that, you know, the theory, you know, the law of gravity, if all of a sudden things started not falling down, it would have to be wiped out and admit we were wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, this is the way good science works, is it people do objectively try to go through it and find and learn the truth, you know, or learn reality, because, you know, what's truth? To get the evidence, so that they can get as much evidence as possible. And then it's usually peer-reviewed, so it isn't one person comes up with something, but then they put it out. And then it's other scientists will go over the same experiments and do them. And if they don't come out with the result, they come back and say that.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the way it has to be. And it's all standing there, and it's all waiting to be challenged.
There's a lot of ego involved, unfortunately, and you talk about the difference between being right and being correct, and how difficult that is for many people to not admit that they're no longer right.
Yeah. Well, there's too many of us running around saying that we're right.
Okay. So we're moving along in history, and we're doing things left and right. And you bring up different points in history. Certainly, Nazi Germany is a popular one because so many things went wrong there. But something that I always found interesting was the fact that Hitler wanted to be an artist. And apparently he wasn't very good, and he didn't do well enough to get into the art school that he wanted to go to.
Wasn't that a shame?
Excuse me?
It was a shame that he didn't get in.
Yeah, and look what happened as a result.
Yeah.
And we can learn so much from that, and yet we haven't. Where individuals at a very young age should be encouraged to be creative, encouraged to be imaginative, and encouraged to pursue the things that seem interesting to them, whether they're good at them or not.
Well, sometimes when people are not good at things, I've taught architecture, and it's not good to keep encouraging someone who has no ability or no talent for it. You know, it's better that they find something else for themselves to do. Because in the end, if they're not good, they'll be unhappy also with what they're doing.
But maybe there's a nice way to do it, so that you don't end up, you know, trying to wipe out a race.
Yeah, well, Hitler had some other characteristics that were not so good. There are a lot of other people who couldn't get into art school who didn't do what he did.
Oh, sure. But the idea of encouraging creativity and imagination, you talk about the importance of imagination, and I'm really frightened about the future, because how we've limited our children in terms of imagination development. With television and just how children spend their time is more with less with being creative and imaginative, and more taking in what's being given to them.
I know, and it's becoming, I think, a special problem now with the with Facebook and Twitter and you know, social networking, that they spend so much time. I watched a program on public television about, I think it was, let's see, the digital age or something. In one place, it showed a class of students. I think they were at Harvard, maybe. And they were all sitting in the lecture with computers, screens. And I thought, oh, these guys are all taking notes. No, they weren't. They were communicating with each other.
Mm-hmm. And they were probably like one desk down from each other, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so So the professor in front, he was standing there lecturing away, and I think half the students didn't hear what he was saying.
Well, I'm going to admit that when I was in college back in the late 70s, I used to write little paper notes to some of my friends while the professor was talking, and I didn't catch all of it. And so probably texting and working on a computer communicating is probably not that much different. But
Well, you had certain limitations on how many of those notes you could send.
Absolutely,
around.
And I had to be really.
They don't seem to have any limitations.
I had to be really clever about passing that piece of paper. Your title, Invisible Walls. What does that mean?
Yeah. Well, it meant obstacles that we don't see. In other words, there are things that are holding us back from doing what makes sense, and we don't see what's holding us back. And so the book is trying to explain what those things are.
Yes, and you do such a good job doing it. I just, for the most part, I felt, I want to say inspired, but I also felt comforted. Understanding really helps. It's just like when people have emotional issues and they go to therapy or something, and understanding their problem is like the first step in healing, that when we understand it, we can start to work towards making improvements.
Yeah. One of the problems now is a lot more people need to understand those things.
But the problem is so many people are numb, and so many people don't care, and so many people are in their own worlds, and they're comfortable enough that the status quo is fine while all of this horror is going on around us. Do you think we can institute these changes before we really have to?
I think we already have to. In fact, I think we had to some years ago.
Yeah, 30, 40 years ago.
Yeah. So I think that we've got to do these things, and the sooner the better. And right now on global warming, people in the scientists and so on in this the 350.org and that say we have, you know, maybe 5 years if we don't turn things around in 5 years, it's going to be too late.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll start on a non-reversible plunge.
So
if we look at where we are right now, you know, it doesn't look good at all.
No, there are little pockets of people and organizations doing things, but it's not enough.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay. I'm not going to worry about it right now. I want to understand the problem and then do whatever I can to encourage everyone else to do whatever they can to do whatever we need to do to turn it all around. And I want to believe that.
Yeah, I think one thing that's necessary is for people to know how serious our situation is. And I think that has to get, and then the people have to take it seriously. Then from there they can go on. But first people, I've got to see that we are in trouble.
You talk about violence in this book and how different things can turn a seemingly nice person like your neighbor into someone who does some incredibly violent things, which is frightful. And, you know, since you've written this book, we've had this explosion of reality TV.
Uh-huh.
Which I don't know if you've watched any. I try not to, but I've seen little.
I haven't.
Yeah.
I would like to somehow, but I've always got something else to do.
Something better to do, absolutely. Well, occasionally
I would really like to watch it and see what it is.
Yeah, well, I've watched a few shows only because I knew people that were on them.
Uh-huh.
And so that was my motivation. But what's really scary about it, okay, number one, reality TV really isn't reality because they do a lot of filming and editors come along and edit clips to make a sensational story, and it can really change the way someone looks and appears in a story. But aside from that, these people, most of the time what makes one of these shows so interesting is that people do get violent and people do get selfish and people do things that don't benefit the group, that only benefit themselves. And what makes a lot of these shows really popular is that type of nature, which is frightening.
I have to watch one.
Yeah. The one I've never watched is Survival. I will not watch it. But, you know, you little bits and things creep in every now and then, and you get a gist of things. But it's not, for the most part, except for the one, I forget the name of it, where they build a house for a family in need, which is, you know, a nice story. Most of them are, you know, very competitive, not cooperative, and they can get really violent and bring out the worst in people, which in your book you talk about how it's in all of us, the best and the worst.
Yeah, there's an, without knowing what all this is, I can see one other thing there that's happening, and that is people's attraction to watching such stuff.
Well, you know, it reminds me of so many different things. There were in the Roman times, you know, people used to watch these people go at them, each other, and kill each other.
Yeah.
And even as most recent as here in New York City on Broadway, when Spider-Man first came out and wasn't doing very well, and different actors were having accidents, falling and hurting themselves, people were flocking there because they wanted to see something go wrong.
Oh, geez. Well, I've been told that that's one reason that some people go to auto races.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. So I want to take a break, Peter, and then come back,
sure.
And we're going to talk about all the good things that we can all do to make this world a better place. How about that?
Okay.
Okay, we'll be right back. Hello, I'm Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food, and I'm here with Peter Seidel talking about his book, Invisible Walls, Why We Ignore the Damage We Inflict on the Planet and Ourselves. And, you know, Peter, when I asked you to do this interview, you were saying that your book wasn't exactly about food, and I think it is all about food. Everything in your book, it certainly affects all of the systems we have in place that give us the food we have today, most of it, which I don't even think is food. And then as a result, is giving us the horrible health, wellness or sickness that so many people have today. And it's all related to everything you talk in the book about corporations and politicians and doing things for profit and not for well-being.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about what we can do about it. So there's like a number of different areas that we need to address. There are things we can do ourselves. There are things that we can really try and get our government officials to do, although that's really rough. And then there are the ways we need to educate our children and ourselves.
Yeah. Well, one thing I think, you know, I'm going through this book just for this program and looking at that part. This part is the hardest because a lot of the things that I suggested in the book actually take time to accomplish.
Mm-hmm.
And right now,
we don't have time.
We
don't have a lot of time.
We don't have time. We have got to change things fast. And one way I can see this is, first of all, people have got to see how serious our situation is. And once when people we have to get enough people to see and to care.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one thing that's been falling apart, because at the time that I wrote the book, I think there were more people that cared then than there are now.
Yeah. You know what's interesting? Your book was written in 1998, and then we had this catastrophic event on September 11, 2001. You could almost say that you were predicting the possibility of something like that happening in your book. And we had a great opportunity on September 12th, 2001, and we really blew it.
I think so. I sent 50 op-eds and letters to editors. And what I suggested was several things. One thing, we had to go after the people who had done it, you know, and were planning more things like that. But the others were, we have to figure out why these people are doing it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and get to the bottom of it. And, you know, what are the reasons? Why are these people doing this? And maybe there are things we can do to reduce this. And then another thing, we have to make ourselves less vulnerable. And what have we done? We've just made ourselves more vulnerable.
Yeah. You talked about something in the book, something that when I first heard about the concept, I felt a lot of peace. And that is the way things work on a microscopic and a macroscopic level. So if we think about a living cell and how it combines with another cell and becomes a larger organism, and then it combines with other similar size organisms, and that whole group becomes a larger organism, and it goes on and on like that, and then we finally have plants, and we have animals, and people come together as a group, and we have a village and a city and a nation. And I found this to be beautiful. I found this when I first read something that talked about this. I found that all of a sudden life made sense to me, and there was an order, and there seemed to be an objective on the planet where we could all cooperate beyond borders and work together as one cooperative organism on the planet.
Yeah. You know, if you just think, this world, we could all live wonderfully on it if we would all put our minds to getting along with each other and the planet and live accordingly. We could be living wonderfully on the Earth, but we can't seem to live with each other, and we can't seem to stop brutalizing the planet. If you think about all the things that are going wrong, they're all basically caused by efforts of people to improve their own situation.
Mm-hmm.
Gone wrong.
Okay. So I have this vision of what the world could be, and that's nice. And we have a long way to get there. But I like to think that if enough of us, a mass, could really realize what's going on today, I think we could fix things pretty quickly. And the question is, how do we get to that point? I don't have that answer. I can just hope.
I don't either. But this is what we've got to do.
Yeah, we have to do a lot of talking fast.
Yeah. I think that people who know something and who care something have to get out there and tell other people. You know, every year I write a greeting to all the people I send Christmas cards to, and I put a lot of things in there. I tell what I think is. Is without getting, you know, waving my finger too much, of trying to make people aware of what's happening. And I think we have to tell people that. In the past, I was very meek about that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't want to turn all my friends and relatives off. More recent times, I thought, my gosh, I'd better turn them on, or we're not going to get to where we want to go.
Yeah, it's a really delicate place to be, because I don't know who you're sending these cards to, but I'm imagining that many of them are rolling their eyes when they receive some of this information, unfortunately.
I know it.
But what I know is I've been talking about a lot of this, especially with respect to food, because that's where my passion lies, with many people for decades. And I have discovered that people need to hear this information over and over and over and over before the light goes on.
Yeah.
And maybe that's part of our limited brain. I don't know.
It is. We are that way. No, I know if there's, you know, say a nice play in town that sounds interesting to me, and I hear about it, I'm likely to forget about it. So they've got to tell me over and over a number of times, and then it really sinks in, and I go.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And we are that way.
And that's where media and advertising is so important, and where they're really not doing what they could and should be doing at this point, because they really have an audience. And if the message was that doing certain things were hip and sexy and good for the planet, you know, more people would be doing them faster.
Yeah.
It's not that hard. I don't think so.
The trouble is advertising. The advertising people, of course, are making a living. And they are performing a function for people who want to sell something, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is what they're doing. And I came across, I was in a library. Sometimes I pick things up. It's interesting. This was many years ago. I picked up Advertising Age, I think it was called. And I started looking through it. And there was a full-page ad. And on the ad, there was a big line that went across, and it went up. And what it said was that the number of times you repeated something, the number of times it improves the sales. In other words, if you double the advertising,
mm-hmm.
the sales double.
mm-hmm. Money makes
this
money.
This is the way we are.
Well, that says something about humanity, and I don't want to get all dark here, but are we really worth saving?
Well, I think so.
Yeah, I think so too.
I think I think we are the ultimate peak of the pyramid of things that exist in the physical world.
The thing is that those of us who are relatively privileged and have a job and, you know, have a home and can feed ourselves relatively well and have an opportunity to take a vacation and educate our children, and we work for some sort of company or business, it takes a lot of courage to speak out, to do something a little different, to say something isn't quite right when everybody else is going in a different direction. And although
it does.
Yeah, we can watch a movie, for example, and we love the whistleblower. We love the hero that does that sort of thing. But most of us are not like that.
Yeah. Well, it took me a while. I'm a very shy person and all of that. And it took me a while to really come out and say, well, by golly, I'm going to tell all these people. even if it turns them off and they turn their backs on me, I'm going to tell them. Because up until that point, you know, I didn't want to, you know, turn off all my friends and relatives, and then finally I said, no, I better do it.
Now, how do you live your life, if you don't mind my asking, that you think is beneficial to for the planet? Do you have a certain lifestyle that you think might be helpful for others to emulate?
Well, what I do myself for myself is, and now I'm a pretty old knucker. I am. I'm 85.
Good for you.
And I'm a widower, so I've always thought, well, I'll live like, you know, the idea of living like a monk has always had an appeal. Mm-hmm. And I said, and I will just devote myself to trying to write things about what I think, and try to utilize what I write in the best ways that I can. And this is what I do. I spend my time trying to do that. But but it's difficult for me because I'm a visual person. I'm an architect, planner, and not a writer. But I write.
Well, you write very well, Peter. You've made some very clear points, and
I try to say things very clearly and understandably, and then I have the help of a very good editor.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe because of my background too, architects and urban planners need to look at a whole picture, you know, because in a building or a city, everything has got to work together. And so you sort of look at all of this at once, and you see it and see how everything is connected and inter functions and affects everything else. And I think that this helps. And so that is the benefit. And then the difficult part that I deal with is the writing.
You mentioned in the book how so many of us are specialists now, and things have gotten so complicated, and everybody knows their specialization, and as a result, we really don't have a good picture of what's going on.
Yes, this is one of the really big problems, is the fact that we are all living in these little boxes with tunnel vision, and society rewards people who do that.
Yeah, there are so many different issues we've got going on with the environment. We have genetically modified food in New York. We're getting hysterical about fracking. And there are all these different issues going on. And when I think about my fellow engineers that are involved in working on a project, it helped me understand, you know, why are they developing something that really isn't beneficial for the planet? And it's because they're not looking outside of their box.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's
really
unfortunate.
So many people are just doing their job. You know, they know that what they're doing, if they think about it, they can see what they're doing is not necessarily helpful.
But they don't want to think about it.
But they do these things.
Yeah.
You know, there's scientists who develop nuclear weapons and rockets for North Korea.
Mm-hmm. Oh, goodness. Okay, well, I think it's great that you're doing what you're doing, and you're 85, and you're writing, and you're trying to make this world a better place. I think one of the things that's unfortunate in our society, and especially as the economy is tanking in the toilet, we are not utilizing all the wisdom and knowledge that the older generations, 50-plus, have. And so many people are losing their jobs and can't find new jobs because they're considered too old. And yet they're all very skilled. They're all very knowledgeable. And so we have this whole pool of stuff we're not working with. And then we have another group of seniors that are, you know, just enjoying their lives, and that's fun, and they're going to buffets and traveling around and enjoying their lives. That's nice. But it would really be great if we could utilize all of this knowledge and talent.
Yeah. Yeah, it would be, and unfortunately, too often, there isn't an opportunity to given to people to be able to do these things.
Yeah.
And then also, like I think right now, is that all of us who can't, I think this is one thing, that everybody who does care and understands that we're in trouble has to take it on themselves to expand this knowledge and concern. This is very important.
Yeah, I don't like to paint a gloom and doom picture, although it looks pretty gloomy.
It does.
But I want people to know that the changes we need to make are not going to make life unpleasant. I believe they're going to make life better. Certainly.
Well, go ahead.
Well, People think they're going to be deprived, that they're not going to have their comforts, and I think people will be happier.
Oh yeah, this is the interesting thing. We know a lot about has been learned about happiness, and you know they've tested people who win lotteries. They're very happy at first, but after about 3 months, they're exactly back where they were.
Yeah.
And then they find that some people who have terrible diseases and handicaps, that which of course are very upsetting at first, but after a while they reach a level where they were about as happy as they were before they learned about this.
Yeah.
And so we have a certain level of happiness, and you know, accumulating more stuff or refusing to give up things doesn't have to do with that. The main things of happiness is that you have something that you feel, you know, you're doing something that you enjoy and that has worth, that you have good personal relationships, and these things, happiness takes care of itself.
Mm-hmm. It's not big houses and fancy sneakers and all different kinds of consumables that people think they really need to have.
Yeah. Well, in the book I mentioned about, I was teaching in China. And the students in China, they lived in dorms that had no heat. There was no lights. They were in rooms, even graduate students were in rooms with six bunks. There was, six people in the bunks in one room where they studied, because at the time I was there, the electricity was very scarce, and the lights in the whole building would just go black at 10 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
So they couldn't even study. There was no heat. The hallways, you had to walk or feel your way around the hallways, and it was cold in winter. And in China at that time, there were no elevators in buildings less than 9 floors high.
Oh,
but I found that these students were just as happy as students in the United States.
Wow. Yeah, it's really fascinating. So that's something people need to know, that we can make this world cleaner, we can clean up our environment, and we can be happier, or at least as happy as we are now. But I think a lot of people are not very happy. The last thing we didn't talk about, which is I think is an important piece of this equation, and we just have a couple of minutes, is is population. And obviously part of the problem is there are too many people on this planet.
Absolutely. And this is one thing that governments and people don't seem to understand, that as population goes up, well, there's less of everything for everybody, and the burden on the planet keeps growing. And they seem to think that we can just let it keep growing and growing and growing. And the same is with the economy. You know, that the economy has got to grow. You know, and it can't.
Yeah, growth is not necessarily a good thing.
No, and no. You can't continually grow in a limited space. And we've already gone way too far. You know, the Global Footprint Network tells us that as we live today, we would need to be sustainable. We're not sustainable. We would need 1.5 planets to sustain us the way we're living today. And there's about 15,000 children dying of things related to malnutrition every day, as it is now. And
yeah,
if everybody lived like we did here in the States, we would need 5 planets
it's
to supply us.
Something that
we need.
We can't even visualize. It's crazy. Well, we could go on about talking about this for a long time, but what I want to tell my listeners is to pick up this book, Invisible Walls, While We Ignore the Damage We Inflict on the Planet and Ourselves, by Peter Seidel. It is the book to read. All of our politicians should read it. Everyone should read it. Thank you for writing it, and thank you for joining me on It's All About Food.
Thanks. Well, thanks. I've enjoyed it. And I just might say that I wouldn't change the book at all if I was writing it today.
You know, it's right on, all of it. Okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you so much.
Keep writing. Okay.
Okay.
Okay, I'm Karen Hartglass, and you've been listening to It's All About Food. Earth Day's coming up this Sunday, which is also my birthday, and so If you want to do something for me, go to Facebook.com, Responsible Eating and Living, and give us a like. That's my nonprofit, and we can certainly use your support. And the following week is Veg Week. Check out usvegweek.com by Compassion Over Killing. They've got a veg pledge thing going on. Lots of good things going on. I'm Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to It's All About Food. Have a delicious week. We'll be right back.